What is up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the Sean Jones NBA Show. I'm recording this on Friday, November 1st, and we're about a week and a half into the season, four or five games or so played for most of the teams at this point. And so, the sample size is still obviously very, very small, but I am going to talk through some of the early season observations, and I'm going to do a little game that I'm calling This or That. So I'm going to pose a question and then answer that question, picking between two teams, this team or that team, which is most applicable to answering that question. So with that said, let's go ahead and get right into it. So starting off with the first question. Which team is more in trouble, the Denver Nuggets or the Milwaukee Bucks? And to me, this question is a little bit nuanced because it depends the time frame you're speaking in. If you're talking about just this season, then I think that the Nuggets are much more in trouble than Milwaukee. But if you're talking long term and moving forward for the next couple years, then the answer is obviously the Bucks. But starting with Denver, this thing has been pretty ugly to start the year. I know that they are 2-2, but they easily could be 0-4. I mean, they lost opening night pretty convincingly to the Thunder, then followed that up with a home game against the Clippers, a team that was expected to finish outside of the play-in this season, lost that game at home as well. Then they looked like they were heading for 0-3, playing Toronto, a team, again, that's probably not going to even win 30 games this season. Toronto was winning by double digits virtually the entire game before Denver made a late run. Scotty Barnes gets hurt. It goes to overtime, and they sneak that one out. And they needed every bit of Jokic's 40 points in that one. Not exactly what he wants to be doing every single night, but he kind of had to in that game. Then they followed that up playing in Brooklyn. And same thing, they were down double digits basically the whole game before a late comeback in which they again won in overtime. And that took a 29-point, 18-rebound, 16-assist game out of Nikola Jokic. He's playing 39 minutes per game so far. A lot of that due to the fact that they had two overtime games, but he's never even played the 35 or more in a season in the past. So they're asking a lot out of him. He's leading the league in scoring right now. That's not exactly his forte. Obviously, he can score, but I think he wants to be more of a distributor and initiator for the offense. But he's had no choice but to be a scorer because Denver's offense is just ugly right now. It just hasn't looked the same as it has in the past. Jamal Murray physically doesn't look to be the same player that he's been in the past. I mean, he's nowhere even close to what he's been in the postseason, but even in the regular season, he's been a little bit more consistent, a guy that can get you 20-22 game points a night. And right now he's shooting 38% from the field overall. He doesn't have the same burst getting to the basket. His shot has been a little flat to start the season, and he always starts the year a little bit slow. But maybe we could give him the benefit of the doubt if he wasn't completely unplayable and atrocious over the summer in the Olympics for Team Canada and was one of the biggest reasons why they were bounced early, and also looked really underwhelming in the postseason last year. And health has just been an issue for him, so he just is not as reliable as you'd want him to be as a number two option. And the guys after him just have not been able to step up. I'm sure when they signed Michael Porter Jr. to that big extension, they hoped that, you know, he could one day up his scoring volume into the 20 to 25 points per game area. But his scoring has stagnated year after year. He averaged 17 two years ago, then just under 17 last year, and then this year only at 13. And he just has not been able to up the volume offensively. He's really turned into just a spot-up shooter. He has not developed as a shot creator like you would have hoped, and he hasn't shot the ball well at all to start this season either. Just under 30% from three, just under 40% from the field. And he's 26 now. I don't know if I see him ever getting to what they probably expected out of him. He really is just more of a complimentary shooter at this point. And he's got great size and is improved on the defensive end, but they need him to be able to drop 20 to 25 on a nightly basis if Murray is not going to play at the level that we know is capable at. Then after that, it gets bleak. I mean, Aaron Gordon is what he is, role player. I mean, getting 15 a night out of him is really all you're going to be able to expect, but all of those are just going to be off of plays from Jokic initiating or lobs or backdoor cuts or wide open threes from outside. And then they probably have the worst bench in the NBA. I have repeatedly said this. I said this after they got eliminated last year. I said it in the offseason that they have just, their front office has done a really poor job at surrounding Jokic with the requisite talent to remain a contender. And Christian Brown has played pretty well for them, about as well as you could have hoped. 14 a game to start the season on well over 50%, 36% from deep. But he's not the reliable shooter KCP is. He's still probably not the defender that KCP is. And by moving him into the starting lineup, you leave just a massive hole in the second unit, which is being filled by Russell Westbrook, who has been just an abomination to start the season. I mean, he's 27% from the field so far, 25% from three, and the on-off numbers are just ridiculous with him. When he's on the court, he's only played 79 minutes this season. They are a minus 23.1 in terms of net rating, and then when he's off the court in 123 minutes, they're a plus 11.2. So they've been a really solid team when he's not on the court, but they are forced to give him pretty big minutes. And the minutes with him have been just disastrous, as expected. I mean, I don't know what they thought they were going to unlock out of Russ, but this is just what he is at this point. He's not a good rotation NBA player. It's sad to say for a guy who was so prolific in his prime, but he's 36 years old. It's just not happening for him at this point. And then after him, they don't have any other reliable options. I mean, Dario Saric has been awful thus far shooting the basketball. Peyton Watson, good defensive player. A project on offense is probably an understatement. His shot has not developed at all. Julian Strother has shot the ball pretty well so far, but is kind of a mess defensively. He's kind of a tweener, not really a point guard, not really a off guard, more of a combo guard. And again, he's just unproven, unreliable to this point. And that's pretty much the team. I mean, they've really played those nine guys to this point, and they don't have any guys that seem like they are going to step up from that group of young players outside of Christian Brown. They have very limited assets to improve the roster, unless they were to deal a Michael Porter Jr. in a larger deal, which might be the right move, but they have not shown a willingness to be aggressive on the open market like that. Since they acquired Aaron Gordon back in 2021, they haven't made any meaningful additions whatsoever to this team. And they've let guys like KCP and Bruce Brown walk for nothing. And so Denver, they are a poor offensive team, which is just crazy to say when you have Nikola Jokic on the roster. They are a poor shooting team. They are only 29th in the NBA in three-point attempts per game, which you just cannot contend if you're going to be basically last in three-point attempts. I'm not saying you have to be like the Celtics and shoot 50 a game, but you cannot be last. You have to be at least middle of the pack if you want to be competitive for four rounds in the playoffs. And so, to me, Denver, all of the fears that I called out and other people have called out for this team have kind of come to fruition. Russ is a disaster. The bench is just useless. Jamal Murray looks compromised or regression has occurred in some capacity for him. Michael Porter Jr. stagnated across the board as an offensive player. And maybe worst of all, there seems to be a bit of a rift between Mike Malone and the front office. And I don't blame Mike Malone. He's pissed. He's upset about all the things that I'm saying because he's seeing it play out firsthand. And he's like, what do you want me to do? These young guys aren't ready to play. And we don't have any good veterans that can step in because you keep letting them all walk in free agency. So Denver is concerning. I know they're 2-2, but they could easily be 0-4. It took them two overtime games to beat just Toronto without Scottie Barnes and Brooklyn. And with how deep and just strong the West is, I could see Denver in the 6-7 seed range. It would not shock me if they were a play-in team this year. I do not think they have the talent to knock off a Oklahoma City at this point. I don't think they could knock off Minnesota at this point. I mean, we saw last year they lost to them, and that was with KCP and a little bit more oomph on offense and not having Russell Westbrook on the team, which would be an addition by subtraction at this point. and I'm not sure they can beat Dallas. I'm not even sure they can beat Phoenix. So at this point with Denver, to me, they are just not the juggernaut they were. They are not the offensive force that they were. They are not the contender that they were. They just don't have the depth. They don't have the offensive consistency after Jokic. And I think that there's some real tension going on between the front office and the locker room. And to me, I think they're probably going to still make the playoffs. And I think that they're probably going to be lucky to win one series at this point. And it's such a disservice to Jokic. They have the best player in the world in his prime, and they are just, they're botching it. They are truly, truly just wasting his prime by not going more all in on making big additions, or at least adding around the fringes, because they're so obsessed with this model of developing the young guys and the two timeline thing that, look, Golden State tried this and it didn't work. It doesn't work. There's not an example of where you can just seamlessly slide these guys in. I mean, they haven't made a good draft pick outside of Christian Brown since Michael Porter Jr. back in 2018. That's 6 years with one like rotation level draft pick that they've selected. So if you're a great drafter, sure, that strategy can work. But if you haven't drafted super well, then it's just going to be a flawed strategy and you're not going to continue to be a contender at that level. On the Bucks side of things, it's been really ugly, maybe even uglier than Denver to this point. And if you listen to my podcast, you know I was kind of high on the Bucks this year, and I'm looking like a fool very early in the season for believing in this team as a contender. But they're 1-4 at this point. They beat Philadelphia on opening night with no Paul George and no Joel Embiid, proceeded to lose by double digits to the Bulls, lose by double digits to the Nets, lose by double digits to the Celtics before getting demolished last night by Memphis, trailing by as many as 30 plus points in that game in what was just a complete blowout from the second quarter on. And there's not a lot that's gone right for this team. They look old. They can't stop anybody on defense. Their offense does not have much juice other than Giannis and when Dame is having an on night, which is becoming less and less often. I mean, just last night, he went 1-for-12 from the floor, 0-of-6 from three, probably his worst game as a Buck at this point. And Giannis was like 17-for-22 or something ridiculous like that, 37 points, and they still got absolutely crushed. And like I said, they're old. Dame is 34. Giannis coming up on 30. Brooke Lopez, 36. They're key role players. Bobby Portis is almost 30. Tareen Prince is 30. Pat Connaughton's 32. DeLon Wright's 32. They don't have any young, rejuvenated, athletic, exciting prospects. And similarly to Denver, Milwaukee's done a terrible job of just drafting ready-to-go talent. Given their window, you think they would have gone after a guy who could plug into the... I mean, Ryan Dunn was available when their first-round pick was being taken this past year. And instead, they take A.J. Johnson, who is one of the most raw talents in the draft. Like, completely not close to being ready to go. They say 2 years away from being 2 years away. That's the kind of prospect he is. So it makes no sense why they'd get a guy like him. Tyler Smith, also not ready to compete now. Andre Jackson Jr. has shown some flashes, but Doc Rivers just has a immense reluctance to play him for whatever reason, even though he's proven to be a decent defender, still not a phenomenal shooter from outside. But still, I mean, when you're getting killed by 30, you'd think you could play this guy more than 4 minutes a game, getting a DNP in another game as well. So they just don't look cohesive. The Dame and Giannis fit still doesn't feel as seamless as you would want it to. Dame has been very inconsistent, as mentioned, and they haven't been able to establish any sort of like pick and roll chemistry or really anything like that to this point. But I do think, are they going to be this bad? Probably not. No. I mean, they're not. They're like bottom of the Eastern Conference right now. They're not going to be a bottom feeder. They're going to be at least in the discussion for the playoffs and play-in this year. And I think a lot of that, there is room for optimism in terms of regression to the mean. I mean, Dame is shooting 27% from three this year. Brooke Lopez is shooting 30%. Bobby Portis, 29%. Gary Trent, 28%. Pat Connaughton, 26%. Like, those are not going to stay there. And that's a huge part. I mean, if those guys are all shooting 35% to 36% instead, they probably win the Chicago game and they probably win the Brooklyn game. And they're sitting there at 3-2, and we're all a lot less concerned. So a lot of this probably has to do with some shooting, just poor starts to start the season. And there's no doubt in my mind that those numbers are going to go up for all those guys. They're not going to shoot sub 30%. Most of those guys are at least average, if not well above average, three-point shooters at this point. Plus, at least there is the optimism that Chris Middleton will be back at some point. And so this is what I was talking about earlier when I said that for this season, I'm more concerned for Denver because this is kind of their team. This is what they got, and it is what it is, and we'll see how they fare in the Western Conference. Whereas for this season, I think you can talk yourself into some early shooting slumps for Milwaukee. You can talk yourself into the fact that, hey, we don't have Chris Middleton. When he comes back, it'll push Tyrese Prince from a guy that we're relying on for 30-plus minutes to more of a complimentary nice-to-have off the bench. It will give us a little bit more scoring on the perimeter and shooting. It'll give us more perimeter defense, even though Middleton is obviously not the defender he once was, but he's a hell of a lot better than a lot of the other options they still have at this point. And so there is some buts available with Milwaukee for this season alone, I'm saying, which is why I still believe in them at least to come back from this, still win 45 to 50 games and still be in the mix at least. They're going to have to turn some stuff around, obviously. But for Denver, it feels like there's less answers. There's less things they can do to fix stuff. But back to what I was saying earlier as well, in terms of long term, this is much worse for Milwaukee because with Denver, like, Jokic has not shown any sort of inkling that he might want out at any point soon or anything like that. He seems to love Denver. And a lot of the pieces next to him are a lot younger. Jamal Murray still only 27. Michael Porter Jr., 26. Aaron Gordon still only 29. Christian Brown, 23. They've got a lot of young players on the bench that they're at least giving some minutes. Whereas Milwaukee, this is like the end of the road for most of their guys. And Giannis has been, I mean, flirted with the media in terms of wanting out from Milwaukee many times in the past. And there are legitimate reports out there right now that say that if this thing continues as it is, he could want out as soon as this season. So to me, Milwaukee, if they don't turn things around, like, Giannis is not going to be on the roster next season, maybe not even by the end of this year, whereas that's not the case with Jokic. So long term, I think Milwaukee's in way more trouble because then you trade Giannis, then you suddenly have to probably trade Dame. You're going to get maybe half the value you gave up for him. So they're just going to not be able to recoup those assets. They're going to probably be towards the bottom of the Eastern Conference without any of their own picks with incentive to be bad or tank. Then you're probably going to want to get off Brook Lopez. I mean, it could just be a total fire sale at that point. With Denver, I don't see that happening. I think that they're going to ride out their core and who they've got, at least for a little bit more. But for this season, I think Milwaukee has a better chance to turn it around. So, nuanced answer, in the short term for just this season, I'm more worried about Denver in terms of being able to turn things around or like make a run to the finals. But in the long term, I think Milwaukee absolutely has way, way more to worry about because as soon as Giannis asks out, this thing is a ticking time bomb for Milwaukee to be one of the bottom feeders in the Eastern Conference. And unfortunately, sometimes it is ugly when things like this end. So I could see it going that route. Moving to the next question of this or that, who's the bigger threat in the East of the kind of younger up-and-coming teams, the Cleveland Cavaliers or the Orlando Magic? And a wrench got thrown in this question a little bit because of the news that Paolo Banchero is going to be out for 4 to 6 weeks with the torn oblique injury, which is really, really a bummer. And just starting on the Magic, I mean, it really is just very unfortunate that Paolo got hurt because he was having a spectacular season to start the year. I mean, averaging 29, 9, and 6. He had a 50-point near triple-double earlier this week with 13 rebounds and 9 assists, shooting 16-26 from the field in that game. Followed that one up with a 31-point effort against Chicago. Had another 33-point game. I mean, I said before the season started, one of my predictions was that Paolo Banchero would be one of the first-time All-NBA players this season. And it looked like he was on his way headed to that, comfortably. I mean, not only were the Magic looking very formidable as a team, destroying Miami on opening night, handily taking care of Brooklyn, beating Indiana as well. Like, they, I know they were 3-2, lost to Chicago, but they've looked really good overall. And Paolo was obviously the driving force behind that. But he's not the only one that has taken a step up this year. Jalen Suggs has been spectacular, averaging 17 a game, well over 2 steals a game, 4 assists, 5 rebounds. He shot 43% from 3 on 8 attempts per game, making almost 3.5 per game at this point. And if he develops into a high-volume 3-point shooter, then that changes a lot for them because, I mean, their two biggest weaknesses over the last year or so have been offensive initiation and shooting. And they added KCP, who was supposed to solve the shooting issue. He has shot only 17% from three so far this year, 28% from the floor. So while he's obviously been impactful defensively, he hasn't done much for them on the offensive end at this point. But Jalen Suggs has more than made up for that because he has been shooting the lights out. And there were real question marks about if his shot last year was legit or if it was just one of those hot shooting seasons because he had not shot well in his first 2 years in the league. But this year, he's making it look like it was not only for real, but it's going to continue to get better. And so he's developing into much more of an offensive threat, which they really needed somebody to step up there. Franz Wagner's shot looks like it's back to normal, 39% on the year so far. I know he did leave the last game with an injury, but I don't think it's supposed to be serious. Anthony Black has shown the ability to knock down some open shots too. He's 44% on the season as well, playing 26 minutes a game this year. Was not much of a factor last year, but I mean, he was a top 10 pick just 2 years ago. And the question mark with him was always the shot. He was advertised as a very strong defender, a guard with really good size, a pretty good playmaker and passer. I mean, he's up over 4 assists a game. He's second on the team in assists after Paolo, despite not starting any of the games this season and being only 6th on the team in minutes per game. And really good defensive player, as I mentioned. But the shot was always the question mark. So if he's going to make shots consistently, then that also changes things a ton for them offensively because it gives them just another option in that guard spot next to Suggs. Between him, KCP, Gary Harris has actually shot pretty well to this point. And then Cole Anthony will get some spot minutes here and there as well. But we know what this team brings defensively. They are top 5 in defensive rating once again this season so far. And so it looked like maybe they were ready to ascend to, again, not contention necessarily, but it was on the table they could be a top 4 seed in the East this season after, I mean, they were a top 5 seed last year, so it's not crazy to think about anyway. But Paolo being out really, really hurts that case because that he's going to be gone for over a month, if not 2 months or something like that. And they're going to really struggle offensively. I mean, just the last game against Chicago that they lost, they looked disgusting offensively in the fourth quarter. I mean, I think with like 3 minutes to go in the game, they had only scored 5 minutes or 5 points in the fourth quarter or something like that. So their offensive struggles are only going to get worse with Paolo out. So, but the point of the question was about who's ready to be more of a threat. So look, they're going to slide down the standings a little bit. They're going to lose some extra games they probably would have won without Paolo. But at the end of the day, if he's going to play at an all-NBA level, they're going to be a top 5 defense, then they're going to have a shot against these top teams in come playoff time because they're long, they have size, they have a lot better shooting than they did a year ago, and they've got a go-to guy. And so those are a lot of the boxes that you need to check to succeed in the postseason these days. They're versatile as well. They can switch 1 through 5 in a lot of their lineups. Like, they are well equipped to handle a Boston, for example. They're not going to beat them most likely, but I just mean that they match up well. They're going to be able to match their defensive versatility. It's going to come down to, can they make shots in the same way Boston can? And that's a tough ask, but they at least seem poised to take the next step from last year. I thought last year was a great stepping stone for them. I was a little lower on them coming into the year just because I felt like they still lacked a little bit of some offensive initiation after Paolo. But if Suggs is going to be more prominent offensively, maybe they can do that by committee with him and Franz as kind of secondary guys. But I still think long term, they're probably going to need to add another piece, another dynamic offensive shot creator next to Paolo, because I think Wagner and Suggs are probably more complementary guys. I think that's a great number three and number four right there. They're kind of lacking that number two. So we'll see if they eventually make a move or if maybe one of those guys can blossom into that role, for example. But they've got the runway to do it. I mean, Paolo's only 22. Franz is only 23. Suggs is 23. Like, it's crazy how young this team is. Anthony Black is 21. Even Wendell Carter's only 25, which is crazy to think about. I mean, KCP is really the only guy in his 30s that's getting major minutes for this team. Gary Harris is 30 as well. But for the most part, they are super young. They have all of these assets to improve if they want to use them as well. On the Cleveland side, they have looked like a different team from previous years. And it all starts with the coach, because Kenny Atkinson is known to get more out of less. We saw him do it in Brooklyn back in 2019 before KD and Kyrie joined the team. That was a big reason for why they went there, because they saw the culture and foundation that he had built with that group. And look, JB Bickerstaff, he's an okay coach. He's worthy of being a head coach in the NBA, but I was never super sold on him with this group. There were already reports after they lost in the postseason that maybe there was a bit of a disconnect there, but Atkinson was always going to be an upgrade. But it looks like it's a huge upgrade, because right now Cleveland is number one in offensive rating, number three in defensive rating, and number two in net rating with a plus 18, which is obviously ridiculous. And he seems to just be empowering his guys a little bit more. And in the past, it felt like guys like Mobley and Garland didn't always know when to pick their spots. But this has been such a like by committee approach to the season so far. Like in the first game of the year, they blow out Toronto and Evan Mobley has a big 25 plus point game. Then the second game, nobody had 25 or more. It was everybody chipped in, did their part. They win that game by double digits over Detroit as well. Then against Washington, Donovan Mitchell has a classic Donovan Mitchell game, 30 plus points. They blow out the Wizards in that game. Then against the Knicks, they are losing in the third quarter, make a big comeback sparked by Darius Garland having 34 points, and he was going crazy at the end of that game. Then the other night, they destroy the Lakers, once again led by a dominant Evan Mobley performance. So it's been a little bit of everybody. And it felt like in the past, it was a lot of your turn, my turn between Garland and Mitchell. Mobley and Allen didn't totally know how to fit in all the time offensively just because of the lack of spacing between those two. But I think Atkinson's doing a lot more staggering, which has done wonders for them. I mean, he's always got one of those bigs on the court, one of the guards on the court at all times. And I also think, like Garland, for example, I think he's empowering him to defer less to Mitchell, because I think that was part of the reason why he had such a down year last year, was he was just a little too deferential, not only as a scorer, but also as just a ball handler and playmaker. That was what he excelled at before Mitchell got there. He was a great dual threat as a playmaker and shooter and passer and scorer and all of those things. And then now he turned into more of like a let Mitchell cook, I'll kind of sit in the corner type thing. So I think he's been a little bit more willing to hunt his shot, initiate the offense, and Mitchell's scoring is a little bit down, but I'm sure he's totally fine with that if they're going to keep winning at the rate that they're winning. Mobley has also just looked much more polished offensively this year, posted career high in points so far, 57% from the field, low volume from three, but still 4-for-8 on the season. Good to see those percentages. I really wonder if they're going to encourage him to up that volume a little bit. He's doing 1.6 attempts per game. If he could get up to the 2.5-3 attempts per game, I think if he can sustain that at least 35-36% from out there, it's going to open up this offense a ton. And then Jared Allen, the unsung hero, 18-11 on the year, leading the league in field goal percentage. The guy just goes out there, does his thing, protects the rim, and plays hard on both ends. So Their top four is just so, so solid. We've said this for a while. I still have some concerns about their depth. I mean, Dean Wade has been starting for them in the place of Max Strus, who's been out. And he's been okay. You know, nothing special. Caris LeVert is a good sixth man. But then after him, it's like Sam Merrill, who's really just a three-point shooter, doesn't do much else. Georges Niang, who's a streaky shooter, not much of a defender. Okoro, who has not shot the ball well this season or in years past. And then it gets pretty thin after that. So I do think that they still probably will need to add some depth pieces if they want to legitimately compete in the East. But in terms of regular season, I mean, it wouldn't shock me at all if they were the number one or number two seed. I picked them as the number three seed. I picked them having 50-plus wins. They've had right around 50-plus wins the past 2 years. Donovan Mitchell has basically been a guaranteed 48 or more wins his entire career. And with Kenny Atkinson, I think he is getting more out of this group. I've always liked their collection of talent, but the fit was always the question. And the fit seems to be fitting a lot better than it has in the past. So back to the original question between Orlando and Cleveland. I think it's a little unfair of a question at this point with Paolo out, because I think Cleveland's going to be much better positioned in the standings come playoff times, just because they're presumably healthy and Paolo obviously is not, and he's the most important player on Orlando. But I think that Cleveland is still probably more of a threat, even both at full health, just because I think Donovan Mitchell is a guy who's been there before, has yet to make a conference finals, but he's made the playoffs every single year of his career. We know that he's capable of just completely taking over and dominating a game, if not multiple games, if not a series. We've seen him do it in the past. I think Mobley, still only 23 years old, has looked like a much better version of himself. If they continue to let him grow offensively, that changes a ton for them on the offensive end. I think Darius Garland looks a little bit more comfortable this season. He's shooting the ball much better, 46% from three this year. And then again, Jared Allen just does what he does. So I think that they're going to continue to be a really strong defensive team like they have been for their third year in a row now. The offensive end is where the questions come in. But look, I thought they gave Boston, for a team that was down Donovan Mitchell for a couple games, and it was only a five-game series, it still felt like they showed some fight last year. And I think it really helps that they're building on this. So they get embarrassed by the Knicks 2 years ago in the first round as favorites. Then last year, they win a hard-fought seven-game series against Orlando before falling to Boston. So the natural progression says that they could potentially continue to ascend in the East. And I think New York looks a little discombobulated to start the season. Philadelphia is just not healthy at all, and they've not been able to overcome those injuries to this point. Milwaukee, as mentioned, looks like a total mess. So there are wins to be had in the East. There are series to be won in the East potentially as well. And so I could see Cleveland making a conference finals run this season. I don't know if I see that out of Orlando this year. I think Orlando would be satisfied winning a series this year. That would be a good next step for them. So both of these teams seem a little bit even more formidable than maybe expected. But I think Cleveland ultimately is a bit more prepared to go into the postseason this year and being ready to maybe win a series that people don't expect them to. The next this or that question I have is, which new head coach has had the greater impact on their team this season? And that is J.J. Redick of the Lakers or Mike Budenholzer of the Suns. And starting off with J.J. Redick, and he received a lot of, I don't know, criticism. People were saying it was unfair, privileged to an extent, that he got a head coaching gig after never being a coach in any capacity in the past at the professional level. But he has silenced all those. I mean, I was not on the privilege front, because like, he's an ex-player, and ex-players get these kind of things happen to them all the time. I mean, look at James Jones of the Suns. He like spent half a year in the front office for Phoenix because he had played there in the past. They basically immediately promoted him to general manager, and now he's the president of basketball ops. So like, that stuff happens all the time. If you're a player, people respect you. They know your resume and stuff like that. So that whole part of it was always dumb to me. But I was still a little skeptical, because the first-time head coaches that have never coached before, not a great track record. I think Doc Rivers is really the only previous successful one. And I mean, he is a polarizing figure, to say the least, at the head coaching position. So, but early returns on JJ have been pretty spectacular. I mean, he looks like a just young basketball savant out there to an extent, just with the way he's been able to make the Lakers look more interesting, diversify what they're doing offensively, more attention to detail, more movement offensively, has the team shooting more three-pointers as well. And there's a few areas where I feel like he has just really, really impacted the team. And one of them is just the general professionalism that they have on the court. Feels like a more serious team out there. But also, I mean, you can see this. He's taking advantage of every opportunity to draw up plays for this group. I mean, against Phoenix the other night, there was some possession where they had, I think, one on the shot clock, called timeout to draw up a play, got a wide open three for Gabe Vincent in the corner, and he knocked it down. And that was a huge shot late in the game. So, like, just little things like that where he's trying to clean up around the margins, take advantage of the small opportunities they have in those situations. But also, I think that he has totally unleashed Anthony Davis. We've talked for years on end about how he is going to need to be handed the keys when LeBron gets older and be the number one option on this team. And it's really never happened. I mean, we've been saying this for probably 3-4 years, really since they won the championship. It was kind of like LeBron will ride off into the sunset, AD will pick up as the number one option, but it just had not happened. LeBron was still clearly the number one guy here over the past few seasons. And AD was kind of like a nice number two, but unreliable sometimes, inconsistent. But he's been very consistent to start this season. I mean, he's averaging 31 points per game, 12 rebounds, 3 assists, almost 4 stocks a game. He's had a 36-point game, 35-point game, 31-point game, 29-point game. He's hovered right around the 30-point mark pretty much every game they've had. He's been the go-to option. He's taking almost 4 more shots per game than the next guy in LeBron James. He's just been spectacular. There's really no way around it. They're truly running the offense through him, and they're empowering him to shoot the ball a little bit more from outside. But he's just been so dominant inside, and I think they're just putting him in a better position to succeed there. Whereas before, it was kind of like he'd get a couple of his shots and in the mid-range, he'd fall a little bit too in love with the mid-range shot. And it just led to some inconsistencies offensively. But if he's going to play at a legit, I mean, he's playing at an MVP level, not just like all NBA, all star, like MVP. He'd be a top 5 MVP guy right now, which he has not been that since he left New Orleans, really. So if he's going to play at that level, this majorly raises the ceiling for the Lakers and also raises their floor, because we've seen them look pretty bad at times over the past few seasons. The next thing is Austin Reeves, because when they went on their conference finals run a few years ago, LeBron was a little bit compromised. He didn't really look like himself. And so Austin Reeves was picking up a ton of the offensive slack in terms of a ball handler and initiator and running offense and running the pick and roll. And I think JJ has identified that and has leaned into that. It seems like Reeves is being empowered to be a little bit more of the ball handler and initiator offensively, not just taking some of those touches away from LeBron to have him be able to rest a little bit, but also taking the ball out of D'Angelo Russell's hands a little bit more, which to me is always a good decision, not a Russell guy. But look, Reeves has turned into just a super crafty player, not only as a scorer for himself, but as a distributor. He has a really good feel for drawing fouls and coming off screens and making the right decision as a ball handler. And he's had a great start to the season as well. Career high in points so far this season, shooting well over 50%, shooting 45% from three to start the year. So he is sort of the underutilized player on this team, in my opinion, over the past year or so. JJ's done wonders for him as well. And then Rui Hachimura also playing the best basketball of his career, without a doubt. He's shooting 57% from three to start the season. Not insane volume, but 8-for-14. I mean, it's not nothing. He looks engaged defensively, and he's just been really consistent and reliable for them. And then LeBron has obviously not played super well. He's had some very good games, like against Sacramento, had some very bad games, like the second game against the Suns. But I think that they are finally not phasing him out, but like he's been so relied upon, and it seems like JJ is making a concerted effort to allow him to have nights where he doesn't have to do everything. And he's clearly still capable of doing everything and being the 30-point triple-double threat every single night that we've seen in the past. But he's just doing it less frequently and picking his spots a little bit more. And even the game where he was awful against Phoenix, maybe his worst game as a Laker, one of his worst games is his entire as a pro, to be honest, 11 points on 3 for 14 from the field. They still almost won that game. Like, they were up by, I think, 19 points on the Suns at one point. They only lost by 4. They had a chance to win it late in the game as well. So the fact that they could overcome a LeBron game that bad and nearly win, they're not doing that in years past. And so I think JJ's been just tremendous for them, had a huge impact. I picked them to make the playoffs as the 7th seed, I believe. I know a lot of people had them out of the playoffs, maybe even out of the play-in, depending on how you felt about some of the other teams. But it looks like not only are they clearly a playoff team, I know they're 3-2, they got killed by Cleveland the other night, but that was their first non-competitive game they had had after starting 3-0. But not only do they look like a playoff team so far, they look like a team that could be a little frisky in the playoffs. I mean, if AD is going to play as an MVP level and Reeves is going to be a little bit more unleashed and Rui Hachimura is going to be more than just a so-so role player but a reliable, good starter, then it, you know, there's a lot to like about them. I still think they are very thin on the bench. I don't like D'Angelo Russell with this team as a fit. I don't really like any of their bench pieces. I think Gabe Vincent is an okay player. I think Dalton Knecht could maybe have some moments, but he's still a rookie, and I don't really trust him at this point. Max Christie has been terrible so far as a shooter and offensively. Jackson Hayes, Cam Reddish, just not guys that I trust personally. I know Christian Wood and Jared Vanderbilt will be back at some point. Those guys are kind of one-way players in their own right. Vanderbilt defensively, Wood offensively. So they're not the solving of their problems necessarily. But they've got moves to make, and I think that because of how good they've looked with the group they have, it will incentivize the front office to decide, oh, hey, like, we might have something here if we added a Zach LaVine or if we consolidate for D'Angelo Russell's contract into two really solid two-way role players, for example, along with their picks. So they've got options, and JJ is the number one reason, in my opinion, for why they're at where they're at. And so credit to him. It looks like they nailed that hire. I know it's very early, but the vibes just seem to be a lot better, and it looks like they are bought into what he is selling, which is really all you can ask out of a coach, on top of being a great X's and O guys, which it seems like he's also pretty solid there. And on the Suns and Coach Bud side of things, I think a lot of people liked this hire for Phoenix. It's so funny with the Suns because people were so low on them after last year. People said they were a blow it up candidate, that their window was completely over. And then as the season kind of crept up on us this year, a lot of people were back buying into Phoenix. They were kind of in on the Suns. People were like picking them as a top three seed, thinking that they could make some noise. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that the West is kind of, a lot of the teams on paper got worse. I mean, Denver's worse on paper. Minnesota, a lot of people thought were worse on paper. And the Clippers, obviously not who they were last year. So there were some extra wins to be had. And so I think people liked Phoenix as a team that could take some of those extra wins. But part of that is Cuz Budenholzer. And people really liked the addition of him, as did I, because he's a very good, proven championship coach. And he has been consistently good everywhere he's gone with both Atlanta and Milwaukee. And now it looks like Phoenix. They're 4-1 now. Look, they've had some inconsistent moments, as they did last year. But last year, in a lot of those games where they had inconsistent moments, they would lose those games. This year, they're winning those games. They've had two games against the Clippers. The first one, they were down 8 with like 4 minutes to go in the fourth, ended up winning that in overtime. The game last night, they were down 21 points at one point, got down immediately by 18-19 in the first quarter. They start 15 for 15 from the field in the third quarter, go on to win that game. Not handily, but like they had, it felt like they had it pretty much good after that hot run. Lakers game, they win that game after being down 19 in the first half. So they've had some really good comeback wins. As I said, they've been inconsistent, but they've showed fight and the ability to win some games despite having some ugly moments, which last year they didn't win a lot of games that they had those moments. But in terms of just playing style and stuff, I mean, Coach Bud has them taking way more three-pointers. Last year they shot only 32.6 threes per game, which was 25th in the NBA. This year they're shooting just under 38 threes per game, which is top 10 in the NBA. I know five extra threes doesn't sound like a huge difference, but it is over the grand scheme of things. I mean, last year they were getting outshot from three regularly. This year they are outshooting teams from three pretty regularly. And last year they were still a really good percentage team from outside, but they just didn't have the volume. This year they're upping that volume to match the efficiency because they've got a lot of really good three-point shooters on this team. Booker is also posting a career high in attempts from three this season, up close to eight per game. And aside from just the shooting, which everybody knew that was going to be helped by Bud, that's kind of one of his things, is offensively get a ton of threes up. He did it with Milwaukee, he did it with Atlanta. He's been consistently in the top six or seven in terms of three-point shooting volume as a coach throughout his entire career. But also, and this might go a little bit against some of the conventional thought on Bud, but he's shown a lot of flexibility and ability to adjust in games. And I know that that's kind of what pushed him out of Milwaukee, is his inability to adjust in the postseason. He was kind of live or die by his system. But I think that he's grown as a coach because I've seen a lot of adaptability mid-game from him. One great example is the center position, because last year Vogel was very reluctant to go small ball and experiment with Kevin Durant playing the five or going even smaller with like a Royce O'Neal there, which they've done some this year already. And just to put numbers behind that, I mean, last year Jusuf Nurkić only had 19 games out of the 76 that he played in which he played less than 24 minutes. So far this season, in five games, Nurkić has played less than 24 minutes in four of those five games. So he is moving away from traditional centers a lot more this year. He's also been willing to bench Nurkić when he hasn't been playing well. And let me tell you, he has not been playing well. He's rode Mason Plumlee when he's had to. And they've done a lot of small ball with Royce O'Neal playing effectively the five defensively, Kevin Durant playing the five, Ryan Dunn getting some minutes at the five. Like, Bud has just been way more willing to experiment with lineups and try out different looks when guys aren't playing well, where it felt like last year Vogel was just going to live or die with the Nurkić and Drew Eubanks after him in the rotation. And Eubanks was awful for the team last year. And Nurkić was a little better last year, but he's been just atrocious this year. I mean, the on-off stuff for Nurkić, when he's off the court, they are a plus 13.6 net rating in 137 minutes. When he's on the court, they're a minus 10.8 in 108 minutes. So they're blowing teams out when he's off the court. They're getting blown out when he's on the court. So, I mean, that right there, the fact that he's willing to see that and ride other options, let Mason Plumlee get a little bit more than you maybe had planned going into the night, try out Royce O'Neal and KD at the five, like those kind of that kind of adaptability just wasn't there last year. On top of the shooting threes, on top of just the buy-in, it feels like the team has more. I mean, it seemed like they just didn't like Vogel very much. It seems like they're all bought in on Bud as a coach. And he's also empowering his young guys. I mean, Ryan Dunn has started multiple games now, and he looks like a revelation with his shot. The guy was advertised as the worst wing shooter in the draft, 20% from three in college. He's leading all rookies in three-pointers made so far, and he's shooting 44% from deep. Made four three-pointers last night against the Clippers. So the fact that he's willing to instill that confidence in his young guy, throw him out there, Bud has just been great for this team so far, in a lot in the same way that JJ has been. And for Phoenix, to me, I mean, I picked them as a top three seed, didn't love them come postseason time, and I still kind of feel the same in the sense that if they upgrade the Nurkić position, if they can get a center that either stretches the floor or is a elite rim protector, right now Nurkić does neither. If they can get somebody who does one of those things, then I think I could believe in them as a team that could make a conference finals run and maybe beat anybody outside of Oklahoma City in the West. But with Nurkić at the center position, I just think that that is going to be too big of a flaw for them to overcome, because right now it is a huge flaw. And let me tell you, this team is deep. This is not last year's Phoenix team where they're playing Nasir Little and Jordan Goodwin and Kata Bates Diop and Yuta Watanabe and Josh Okogie. Like, they got legit 8, 9, 10 rotation players that are like good players, would be playing on any team. Grayson Allen now off the bench. Royce O'Neal has been spectacular to start the season. Ryan Dunn, who I already touched on, is a no-brainer two-way rotation player at this point. Monte Morris has barely even had to play for them because they've got so many other solid guys, with Tyus Jones coming in as the starting point guard as well. Mason Plumlee, not spectacular, a big upgrade over Drew Eubanks from last year. So they are deep. They really have all the things you could want on a championship level team, outside of the fact that they have a huge, huge deficiency at the center position. And Nurkic has just killed him on both ends. He's a terrible finisher. He's super sloppy with the ball. I mean, he's been extremely turnover prone, with just stupid turnovers basically all year. His shot that he's been trying out has not been effective. I think he's like 2 for 13 on the season from deep or something like that. And defensively, he's just okay at best. He can't guard the perimeter and he's not a rim protector. He's just a big body down there, which, you know, that helps, but he's not doing much else impactfully on that side of the ball. So in terms of who's been more impactful, I am going to lean JJ on this, just because I think the Lakers went from not contenders at all, maybe not even make the playoffs, to comfortably in the playoffs and could win a series or two or something like that. So I think that Phoenix, a lot of their turnaround had to do with personnel, because they added Tyus Jones. They have a full year of Royce O'Neal. They drafted Ryan Dunn. They upgraded to Mason Plumlee at the backup center. So they had a lot of personnel upgrades that I think are a big part of why they look really good to start the year. And I think for the Lakers, they didn't add anybody except for Dalton Connect and Bronny James, basically. So to me, it's all about coaching for them, and it's been night and day from last year to this year. So I will go with JJ there. The next question is, who is creating more separation in their respective conference between the Oklahoma City Thunder and the Boston Celtics? So starting with the Celtics, they picked off right where they left off from last season. They look like they haven't skipped a beat. They have had no Porzingis, but it has been no problem so far. They are 4-1 with some dominant wins. And their only loss coming last game against Indiana was a game in which they trailed by 24 points in the third quarter, still ended up coming back to lose that game in overtime. So even when it seems like you got them, they just keep fighting and fighting, and they're just so damn hard to take down. So they got 124 offensive rating on the season, which is second in the NBA. Opening night against New York, that was one of the most ridiculous three-point performances I've ever seen personally. Obviously, they tied the record for most threes made in a game. And especially until that end where they were missing a bunch, like, it just felt like every single shot was going in. They were manipulating the defense perfectly, putting Cat in all of the actions, and he was not doing a very good job at defending the three-point line. And they've just got so many guys that can beat you. I mean, just look at the three-point percentages this year. Jrue Holiday's 55%, Peyton Pritchard 47%, and that's on 10 attempts per game. He's getting a lot more run than he did last year. Al Horford's still 60% from three, Derek White 47%. Tatum at 38% on 12 attempts per game. He's making almost 5 a game, so his volume is way up from deep. And it looks like he finally fixed the little hitch he had in his shot. It looks a lot more smooth. Which obviously he struggled a lot with his outside shot for a big portion of last season, especially in the playoffs, and then especially the Olympics. People want to wonder why he didn't play in the Olympics. It's because he couldn't make a shot. He literally didn't make a single outside shot the entire time there, even in the exhibition game. So, but it looks like he's fixed that shot, at least to an extent. He looks a lot more like his old self shooting from outside. And then Jaylen Brown has not shot the ball super well, but at least he's bringing the same confidence into this year, averaging more shots a game than Tatum has to this point. And I'm sure he will shoot it better as the season goes along. But Luke Kornet has been very solid off the bench. Tillman and Hauser haven't really shot it super well, but, you know, they still have been giving good minutes. Jordan Walsh has been getting a little bit more run as well. But look, they don't even have Porzingis. He should be back within the next month or two. And it doesn't look like they're going to skip much of a beat without him. And so people are wondering, can this team win 70 games this season? And I'm not going to go that far. I had Boston as the one seed going into the year. Nothing has changed in my thought process there. I think that they are going to be a dominant regular season team. They're going to build off what they did last year. And it does kind of look like they're creating quite a bit of separation in the East. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that Milwaukee looks like they are a complete dumpster fire. Philadelphia, Embiid still has not played a game. Paul George has still not played a game. We have no idea when Embiid's coming back. They've looked not good without those two guys, with Maxey having to do way too much offensively, and he's been very inefficient as a result. And so that's two of their three biggest threats coming into the year. Then the Knicks have looked a little out of sorts. I mean, it looks like Brunson's off to a slow start. Cat finally had a big game last game, but he had been majorly underutilized, especially as a floor spacer in the first few games, shooting only like a couple threes per game, which you acquired him to be the elite floor spacing big, and he just wasn't doing that. Then Bridges had a wonky start with the whole stuff around his shooting, and Anunoby has been a little quiet to start the year. So it's been a work in progress for them, to say the least, and they'll work through it. But again, Boston just looks head and shoulders better than anyone in the East right now. Even Cleveland, who I previously talked about, like, you can't take them as a team that can seriously beat Boston until we see them beat like anybody else that's at least close to their level, you know. They're still young, inexperienced, and they don't have the firepower that Boston does on both ends of the court. So it seems like Boston, most people picked them out of the East again. I did not, out of a sheer parity-led decision, because I still think that the parity is too great for a team to repeat unless they are a completely dominant team, which, hey, Boston might be. They're looking like they are. But my point is, they could still have a really, really, really good regular season, and then we'll see in the playoffs. But for right now, I think they are head and shoulders the number one team in the East in all facets. Missoula is just proving to be a phenomenal head coach, the perfect guy for this set of personnel and this system and all of those things. And so as of right now, it's hard not to think that Boston's going to at least repeat the Eastern Conference championship they had last season. We'll see about the NBA championship, but it's hard to bet against them based on what we've seen so far. And I don't think it's going to slow down anytime soon, at the very least. And on the Thunder side, you know, a lot of people were really high on OKC coming in this year. I had him as the one seed. I picked him to win the championship preseason. But I was feeling maybe not great about it, only because I felt like they were such the trendy pick. Everyone's in love with them. But they have lived up to the bill so far through four games. They've won all four games by double digits, including a win in Denver on opening night. And they have been just devastating defensively. They lead the NBA in defensive rating with a 91 defensive rating. Just to put into perspective, last season, Minnesota led the league in defensive rating with a 109. So they are 18 points lower than the number one defense last year, which, I'll just tell you now, it's not sustainable. They're not going to have a 91 defensive rating by the end of the year. But the point is, that is just how dominant they've been. They have just elite defenders across the board. Shea, Chet, J-Dub, Lou Dort, Kayson Wallace, Alex Caruso. Like, go down the list. That's not even to mention that Hartenstein hasn't even played a single game yet. He is very good on that end of the court as well. And, you know, they haven't even played that great offensively. They're only 24th in offensive rating, but it doesn't matter. They've still blown every team out just because of how, elite and demoralizing they've been defensively. But the one person who has been extremely effective offensively is Chet Holmgren, who has upped his scoring, upped his rebounding, upped his assists, his blocks, his steals, his field goal percentage. Across the board, he looks like he's taking a leap. I know it's only four games, but he's been just tremendous on both ends. 3.5 blocks a game, leading the NBA in that category. Just under 23 points per game, shooting 59% from the field. He hasn't shot it super, super well from outside, only 33%. But he's looked dominant offensively inside the arc. And I talked about preseason, how I thought that in order for Oklahoma City to win the championship, they were going to need a second reliable score to either emerge or be added externally, because I thought that's where they fell short in the postseason last year, is that Shea did his thing, got his buckets, got his points, but there was no reliable second guy. Jalen Williams just was underwhelming. Chet looked a little overwhelmed at times. And so one of those guys was going to have to step up to be the clear-cut number two, or they were going to have to add somebody externally to be that person. And I thought Jalen Williams was the likely candidate to kind of steal that slot. But Chet appears to be the guy right now. I mean, we will see if he keeps this up, if he's going to average in the 20 to 25 point per game range all season, 11 rebounds as well to go along with it. But if he keeps it up, then that is sort of that void that I thought was unfilled could just be filled by him. And so he's been awesome, all-star level, all NBA level, to be honest with you, all defensive player of the year type good on that end as well. And so it's only going to help him when Hartenstein's back, because he can take pressure on him to be the center as a rebounder and as a big body to guard some of the bigger players in the league. He can be more of a roamer defensively. He can hang out in the perimeter a little bit more if he wants to offensively. And they'll probably stagger those guys. So right now, I mean, the other Jalen Williams is also out injured. So it's been really a by-committee approach for the backup center minutes. Usman Dang has been getting a lot of those, but he's been kind of a mixed bag on both ends of the court. I don't know if he's really ready to be a rotation guy on a win-now team like OKC. But regardless, they look spectacular as a team. And the rest of the West has been kind of shaky, you know? Either shaky or just on paper worse across the board. Like Denver, as I already mentioned, they've struggled mightily. They are without any reliable bench pieces, and they just look worse on paper. Minnesota, the Randall for Towns swap. I am down on them a little bit more than I would have been before that trade. I just think it's a worse fit, and we've seen some of the clunkiness play out in some of the games they've had to this point. Dallas, they have looked decent, but, you know, Luka hasn't played particularly well to start the season. I still think they're going to have some questions on their perimeter defense. They got beat pretty bad there last night against Houston in a game they probably should have won. The Clippers obviously are sort of a non-factor this season. Memphis has looked not nearly as good as they were potentially advertised. The Pelicans have been kind of a mess to this point as well. Golden State looks good, but Steph is out for at least the next couple games as well. And so, you know, the gap looks to be there between OKC and the rest of the West, despite how stacked the West is. I mean, they're just so good defensively. They have star power on offense with SGA. They have young, youthful, athletic, long, elite defensive two-way guys in Chet and Jalen Williams. Like, they're deep. They have all the picks you could want to go out and make a move. If Giannis becomes available, then they become a very intriguing team for him as well. But the gap looks to be there. And so right now it looks like Boston and OKC are really in their own league in terms of just the rest of the NBA right now. And so the question is, who's created more of a gap? And I do still think it's Boston, just because they've won a championship. They know what it takes. OKC still has not made it out of the second round. I still think the West is deeper and better than the East. Like Boston, whoever they play in the first round, it's going to be a cakewalk, whether it's Miami, Atlanta, maybe even Charlotte, something like that. Like, it's going to be a sweep most likely. OKC, whoever they play in the first round, could be a legitimately really good team. It could be a team like the Lakers, who have won a championship with their top guys. It could be a team like Denver. Wouldn't really even shock me if they were that low. Even a New Orleans, a Sacramento, they've got star power, you know. So I think that just OKC, they've looked great through four games. They need to clean some stuff off offensively. I still think they could probably benefit from making another deal. But they look formidable. They look like the favorites. They look like a team that is the team to beat without a doubt, just like Boston does. But I think with Philadelphia, Milwaukee not looking like even remotely contenders right now, and then the Paolo injury, and then New York looking kind of meh at times, I think Boston is probably separating themselves a little bit more than Oklahoma City, but they both appear to be doing so at the current moment. Okay, and now I'm just going to do some quick hitters on some smaller ones. Bigger surprise, the Clippers or Warriors to this point. I know the Clippers are 2-3, so it's hard to say that they're much of a surprise, but I have personally been very surprised at the fact that they have just been as pesky as they have been. All their games have been close. They beat Denver. They almost beat Phoenix twice. They've just been a team that's annoying to play. They've been phenomenal defensively. They've had their lulls offensively, obviously, but they are just a lot more competitive than I thought they would be. I thought they were going to be a total mess. And look, they're probably still not going to win 40 games, but at least they're like an annoying team to play. And that's really all you could ask for a group that's right now playing with one star, maybe like not even a star in James Harden at this point, and a bunch of role players. But they've been great, in my opinion, in terms of like what the expectations for the team coming into the year were. Then you've got Golden State, who's 4-1. They've definitely had a bit of a easy schedule to this point. They've played New Orleans twice. They played the Clippers, they played the Jazz, they played Portland. So they haven't really been tested. They still have Rockets and Wizards in their next two. So, I mean, they could even be 6-1. But Steph is out. So it's a little surprising still that they're 4-1. But Buddy Hield has looked like the second coming of Klay Thompson. It's fair to wonder if he could have been a much better player in a system like this in the past. But who knows? Pajemski has had some up and down shooting, but been very solid all-around player. You guys know Pods is my guy. Wiggins looked like the old Wiggins a little bit. He's missed the last couple games, but shot the ball very well, been 20 points per game so far. Draymond is, you know, looks like he's maybe lost a little bit of a step. And then Kuminga has not played well. He got benched. But again, overall, they look like they could play 11, 12 guys on any given night. They're 4-1 despite the easy schedule. And so both teams a little bit surprising. I actually am going to go with the Clippers. I'm more surprised at how they've looked and how they've played, even though Golden State has the number one net rating in the NBA and they're 4-1. I think a lot of that has to do with the schedule when they start to play some tougher teams. I think reality might set in, especially if Steph is still going to be out. Without him, I do not think they are going to be able to even sniff the playoffs, maybe not even the play-in. But I still think they'll be competitive. I think that they will have a shot to make the postseason. I had them as the 9 seed, so I still think they're going to be right around that range. But the Clippers, they could be a little better than I expected. I had them winning less than 30 games, and that looks like they're probably better than a 30-win team at this point. Next question is, which team more desperately needs to make a trade or a move? And that is the Pelicans or the Rockets. And the Pelicans have been a dumpster fire to this point. They've been a freaking mess out there. They're 28th in the league in net rating at -8.3. They're 2-3. Their offense has been awful, 106 net rating, 28th in the league. Defense has been middle of the pack at 114.5, 17th in the league. And there's so many reasons why they need to make a move. One is because they don't have an actual reliable center on the roster. Look, Ves Mese has looked really solid as a rookie. He's averaging just under 2 blocks a game, 7 points, 5 rebounds in 20 minutes, but he has not been a good offensive player, only 46% from the field, total non-shooter, doesn't offer anything in the playmaking department. Like, he is not ready to be thrust into a starting role of 25 to 30 minutes per game, and Daniel Tice is not a guy who should be doing that in the year 2024 either. And so they don't have a center. I talked about that preseason. They just don't have one. They need a center. There's too many teams with too many good big players that they just are not going to be able to guard. But the bigger issue here is the clunky fit, which we've talked about for a long time. The Pelicans this year, with Zion on the court by himself without Ingram, are a -2.7. With Ingram on the court without Zion, they're a -4. And when they share the court, they are -15. They're getting killed when they share the court together. And Zion has been terrible to start the season, by far his worst start to a season ever, only 36% from the field, 25% from threes, had some terrible offensive games. And Ingram has been pretty good. I mean, 51%, 41% from three, 90% from the line, so he shot the ball well. But it's just a bad fit. It's been a bad fit for a while. The numbers bear it out, and they just have too many holes elsewhere to justify keeping this group of, albeit talented players together. They've got Herb Jones, who's out for a little bit now as well. DeJounte Murray's going to be out for a while with the broken hand. Trey Murphy still hasn't played a game. So health obviously is a factor in this. But this group of players is just such a hodgepodge. They need to consolidate. They need to just probably move off of Ingram, even though he's played really well for them, just because he's the most movable piece. You're not going to trade Zion at this point. And you're not going to get much for CJ McCollum. And you could trade Herb Jones, but I think he's the kind of guy that you do want to keep around. They just gave Trey Murphy an extension. So Ingram seems like the odd man out. I think they're going to make a trade, like, definitely midseason this year, as I predicted before the season starts, because it doesn't look good. And they cannot continue this with this group if they're going to look this badly, especially the Zion Ingram pairing looking so poorly together. Then the Houston side of things, they don't necessarily have any crazy clunky fits. I know that Jalen Green and Şengün have been much talked about as a potentially not great fit. But to me, it's more they just got so many guys. They got so many guys. I mean, they start VanVleet, Brooks, Green, Smith, and Şengün. And then Amen Thompson's looked good off the bench. Tari Eason gets minutes. Cam Whitmore, Steven Adams, Jock Landale, Reed Shepard, Jayshon Tate doesn't even play anymore. Like, they could easily consolidate some of these because they've got guys like Tari Eason's playing only 18 minutes a game. He could be a close to 25-minute per game guy. Steven Adams and Jock Landale, they're splitting the backup center minutes. They probably don't need both of those guys on the roster. Reed Shepard's only playing 9 minutes a game. I'm a big Reed Shepard guy. He needs to be getting more than 9 minutes per game. I know he hasn't shot the ball super well, but a lot of that is because he hasn't gotten the opportunity to shoot like consistently in games. It's really hard when you're only playing under 10 minutes a game to get in any sort of rhythm. Cam Whitmore, I'm not the biggest Cam Whitmore guy, but again, offensive guy that needs some touches and some rhythm. He's shot the ball very poorly this season, and a lot of that's because he's only getting 12 minutes. So they just seem like a team that could consolidate a little bit, trade a 2-for-1, 3-for-1, something like that. And they've got the assets to make even a bigger deal. I mean, I think Jimmy Butler is going to keep being whispered around until we see the Heat either play better or some resolution there. And I think he could be a fit for this team. I think that I know it doesn't totally line up from a timeline perspective, but it seems like they are motivated to try to go for it now. And so I think that could be a good fit. I think it wouldn't cost them a ton, but they've got the players and the picks to pull it off. I also think Jalen Green, as I've talked about, not my favorite player. I know he's played pretty well this season so far, but I am still skeptical that he is the go-to scorer on a eventual playoff team. So we'll see. But to answer the question, I think New Orleans needs to make a deal more desperately. I think between all the injuries, between the clunky fit, between your two best players, between the massive hole at center, there are too many reasons to sit back and let this thing ride out. So I think the Pelicans need to make a move, if not ASAP, very soon. And that is going to do it for this episode of the Sean Jones NBA Show. We are obviously only 5 games into the season, so there's a lot of things that could change over the span of the next few weeks. I'll probably have my next podcast be maybe around the 15-game mark or something like that. And I'll likely bring back my segment I did last year of Sample Size Roulette, where we talk about if the sample size is big or small enough to believe in certain things that are playing out this season. One of my favorite segments from last year. Going to keep watching, keep enjoying. It's been a fun NBA season so far. Feels like there is a ton of parity throughout the NBA right now, which is always great for watchability. But thank you again for listening, and I will chat with you guys soon. Thank you.